I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The centennial of World War I makes you wonder again what we learn from history. Or is the main lesson that we don't learn anything from history? And still we hunger for the historians who keep sorting the evidence of that horrific clash of European empires, causes, conduct, and consequences of a global war, unheard-of killing, a full breakdown of advanced civilization that had a still deadlier sequel a generation later, and direct effects playing out to this day. Three historians plunge with us into the murk of many questions this hour. Steve Van Evra of MIT is both historian and theorist of the causes of war in general, the Great War in particular, in his recent work. Isabel Hull at Cornell is a specialist in the military mind of Imperial Germany. Adam Tooze is an English historian now teaching at Yale with a big new book coming this fall titled The Deluge, centered on the American reservations about what turned out to be a decisive entry 3 years into the stalemate in 1917. Steve Van Evra in our studio. Strike the keynote here. You've written about the war that poisoned a century. Spell it out.
I think World War I was like a boulder that someone kicks into rolling down a hillside and then collides with other boulders further down the hill, and soon you have a vast landslide wreaking ruin throughout the mountainside, tumbling into the valley below. It had vast damaging effects throughout the 20th century that still continue. There were two really big, if you will, secondary boulders that it kicked into action, and then a bunch of smaller ones that also mattered. The most important was the Russian Revolution. There would have been no Russian Revolution without World War I, because it was World War I that forced the Tsarist regime to mobilize middle-class military officers into the army who did not support the Russian regime. And when the crisis came in 1917-18, those officers did not back the Tsar. And that's why the Bolsheviks were able to gain the upper hand and win the Civil War.
This is still unclear to me. I've been cramming on World War I for a month now. But why did the war stifle a democratic revolution in Russia?
Well, forced the Tsar to recruit disloyal officers. That created a situation where the regime was poorly defended. Then you saw what you often see, which is the most organized element in Russian society that was opposed to the regime took over the situation. They were not the most popular, but the Bolsheviks were the most organized. Less popular than Kerensky, less popular than the Mensheviks, but the most organized. They took over the situation, eventually picked up the sticks from the mess left by the, if you will, implosion of the Russian army. And we've seen that again and again, that when chaos happens, you get the organized guys taken over, who often are not the nicest people at all. So it's very rare. Mass revolutions are very unusual. This one happened because the Russian government was caught, if you will, between the devil and the deep blue sea. They had to have an army strong enough to beat the Germans, but if they mobilized enough people into it, they would be putting officers in their upper command who were not on their side. And they overplayed their hand. They, in the end, recruited people who wouldn't stand by them.
But from there, Lenin, Stalin, the Cold War, a giant mess, or one piece of the mess.
Correct. Then we get this catastrophic chain of events that stem from the Bolshevik takeover. First, you get mass killing in Russia on a grand scale that still hasn't been counted. Perhaps 30 million people murdered by Stalin, if you add it all up. The Ukrainians being slaughtered, the Kulaks being slaughtered, the Chechens, they're just killing on an astounding scale, even greater than Hitler's. Second, you get the breakdown of Allied containment of Germany. Sort of a little noted but very important result of the Russian Revolution was that before 1914, there was sort of a general cooperation among the British, French, and Russians to try to keep the Germans from getting too out of control. That all broke down because the British and Soviets couldn't get along because of ideology. And, Churchill didn't trust the communists, and the communists didn't trust the capitalists. So when there was an effort made in 1938-39 to form a coalition to contain the Germans, they couldn't agree on it. And instead, Stalin cut a deal with Hitler, the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. So there was no effective containment of Germany anymore. So Germany could run wild. And that was a result of the ideological division of the world that stemmed from the Russian Revolution. The Russians weren't going to sort of play ball with Britain and France in containing Germany. And that was a big reason why Hitler went wild. Third, you have the Cold War, which wouldn't have happened without the Russian Revolution. And that in turn unleashed four major wars that killed 1 million people or more each, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, the Afghan War, and the Angola War, and a bunch of smaller wars that also killed tons of people, the Guatemalan Civil War, the El Salvador Civil War, the war in Yemen, which killed many people, the Mozambican Civil War, and so forth. And other things, of course. We had, you know, nearly blew the world up with the Cuban Missile Crisis and several other crises, the Berlin Crisis. And we also had the Chinese Revolution, which I think would not have happened without the Russian Revolution. That in turn was a tragedy for the Chinese people. 25 to 30 million Chinese died in the Great Leap Forward, and millions of others died in the 50s and in the Cultural Revolution.
You make me wonder what turn might have reversed all of that pattern, and when and who might have done it.
Well, I think, you know, once you have a revolution in Russia, you're on a very bad road. I think violent revolutions are proclive to give rise to things like what we saw in the Bolshevik revolution. They bring to power bad leaders, people schooled in violence, movements that are not, if you will, tolerant of internal debate. Basically, assassins tend to the rise to the top of revolutionary movements. So I think, you know, that goose was pretty well cooked when the revolution happened. We were headed for lots of trouble. And that trouble is still with us. Today, North Korea's nuclear problem, we wouldn't have that without World War I, because we wouldn't have it without the Russian Revolution. The reason there's a really bad regime in North Korea is because we had a Cold War, and the Cold War happened because we had World War I.
Would we have nuclear weapons without World War I?
Maybe not. For sure, if you will, both World War I and World War II gave rise to new destructive technology. You often see, you know, in wartime, people want to invent things that can be used to destroy stuff. So World War I, you saw the invention of aerial bombing for the first time, which was really perfected in World War II with the firebombing and then eventually with nuclear weapons. And you saw other, you know, vast expansions of the human capacity to destroy. You had poison gas. You had also expansion of the capacity to conquer with the invention of the tank, and that led to the Blitzkrieg and so forth. So a lot of, if you will, destructive capacity emerged from the two wars.
Steve, I'm thinking of you as a philosophic historian who sees, you know, the big pattern, the theory in a way of the process underway here, and I wonder what in the world is it? Take the technology. You talk about this endless advance of weaponry. Even during the war, it started out with cavalry. It ended with serious bombs being dropped from the air. But when you stand back and try to imagine what, if any, rational process is unfolding here, what do you see? Was anybody noticing what was going on here? Was anybody saying, stop right here? Or is this some sort of childish fantasy?
Well, you know, you turn the people in the back room loose during war and say, you know, get to it. They're gonna invent destruction. That's what they're going to do, and they're not going to think long term. They're going to think, you know, what can we use tomorrow to save us? Don't expect rational things in wartime. You're not going to find them. In fact, I think a key outcome of World War I was two very bad ideas: communism, and then the second big bad result of the war. And I'm now speaking of that second boulder that toppled.
Okay.
Is badness in Germany, of which there were two kind of notable forms of the badness. One was the rise of, or the creation of, Nazi ideology. And Nazis, they thought differently from other people, and their worldview was heavily shaped by the First World War. What they really had was a worldview that you might describe as Darwinism on steroids. Hitler's and his pals thought in, if you will, typical pre-1914 Darwinist terms about the notion that war was inevitable and you live in a tough world and you better be ready to, you know, draw the sword. But they thought that way in even a more intense fashion than their predecessors. Hitler drew very direct analogies to World War I in his assumption that the neighbors of Germany were like wolves ready to pounce, and that therefore Germany had to basically strike down Germany's neighbors before they struck him down, and that specifically Germany had to expand in order to solve the problem that emerged during World War I of the blockade of Germany and the starvation of the Germans. which Germany suffered in the First World War. And Hitler's entire sort of expansionist foreign policy was premised on the notion that Germany has to prevent that from happening again. Never again can we be blockaded and starved. Therefore, we, the Germans, must expand to the east, seize vast farmlands, and become an autarkic economic zone, and specifically a zone that can produce its own food. So he was reacting very directly to World War One. There's a second way in which World War One produced bad ideas in Germany. The German government after the war spent tremendous efforts in secret to inculcate in the German people a false narrative of innocence about the causes of the war and a false other blaming narrative about Versailles and its injustice. And they spent a tremendous amount of effort on it. It wasn't even known that this was going on until long after the war. But they poisoned German public debate, poisoned the schools, poisoned the universities with this narrative of, if you will, self-innocence and other evilness.
What was the line? We didn't do it?
Yeah, the line was we were entirely innocent of causing the war. The war was a product of a British conspiracy to encircle Germany, unleashed by the British without provocation. And then even more outrageously, the Allies, you know, killed our troops. Then at the end of the war, blamed us for causing the war, asked us to pay reparations for the war they started after killing our people. It just shows what basically wolves and knaves our neighbors are. That was the narrative. I think Hitler's, if you will, rhetorical capacities are much exaggerated. He didn't, shall we say, mesmerize the Germans into supporting a war of aggression. He was surfing on a wave of rage that was built on this narrative, this victim narrative. It was a powerful victim narrative that was naturally – it was going to enrage anybody if you believed it.
Which is the price that we paid for an armistice rather than a surrender and a victory, no? And a general clarification, drawing the Germans into another narrative of what had happened. I mean, for amateurs like me, the puzzling thing here is that World War One begins, in effect, with an accident, and it ends without a conclusion. And I hope that fits the theme. Coming up, the American intervention in World War One, as the historian Adam Tooze recounts it, was a conflicted choice. A public-private partnership in which the banker J.P. Morgan took the lead role before Woodrow Wilson made the presidential decision. This is Open Source. We're talking about World War One. I'm Christopher Lydon. The Deluge is the historian Adam Tooze's name for World War One. It's the title of his big new book about the bloody gateway to the New World Order and disorder, with the United States at the center of the story, even before we ended the fight. A main thread of Adam Tooze's story is the zigzag path of the young economic giant toward the center and the center stage of world decisions. In 1916, 2 years into the war, Americans had reelected the president who kept us out of the battle. By the summer of 1917, the same Woodrow Wilson had committed the U.S. to fighting alongside Britain and France against Germany. Adam Tooze was in Paris this week when I got him on the phone to explain the American hand in that war.
Well, I think the first thing to recognize is just quite what a shock the rise of the United States is. If you trawl through the immense volume of literature that's been produced about the July crisis in 1914, which is now so preoccupying Europe, in the commemoration of this terrible event in July and August 1914, what is astonishing is the absence, the sheer absence of the United States from any of those calculations. The United States is not a factor in European power politics in 1914. And as you're saying, 2 years later, by the late summer of 1916, all eyes across the capitals of Europe and Asia are fixed on the United States. And that shift, the sheer suddenness of it, is, I think, the first thing to understand. America's rise as an economic power had been foreseen, and it was visible, really, from the enormously rapid recovery from the Civil War and the dramas of American economic growth in the 1880s and then through in the Gilded Age of the turn of the century. But this sudden shift to the center of global power takes everybody by surprise in its speed. And that, I think, has to be factored in. On the one hand, it produces a sense of alarm on the part of the British, the French, the Germans, and even more in the case of the Japanese. Nobody quite knows what to make of America and its potential power. And on the other hand, within America itself, there's a profound uncertainty, unease about this new role. I mean, Woodrow Wilson is not just, as it were, pandering to American isolationism or some part, some demand on the part of the American public to have no part in this war. It's a much deeper thing. I mean, on the one hand, it's strategic. He believes that America will exercise its power more effectively from outside. But it's also a cultural politics in that an American like Woodrow Wilson is profoundly hostile to the militarist culture of Europe. It's identified with an old world of which he doesn't want America to be part.
Adam Tooze, come back to a big, big player in your telling that I've barely understood. I mean, we all have this vague notion of J.P. Morgan as the man who bankrolled a war. But it all seems different after your book. I mean, here was J.P. Morgan in New York financing a war that the American people voted against in 1916. This was almost a private war.
The role of J.P. Morgan in the first years of World War I is truly extraordinary, as you say, in the sense that J.P. Morgan serves as the banker to Britain, France, Russia, and then also to Italy. It becomes effectively the financial agent for, by far and away, the largest coalition of military powers the world had ever seen up to that point. And through the good offices of J.P. Morgan in 1915 and 1916, the European powers, without the say-so of the American government, and to a degree against the wishes of the American electorate, goes about mobilizing the American economy for war. The orders placed by J.P. Morgan in 1916 exceed the total value of American national exports in 1913. So we have a public-private partnership, if you like, in which the public, the government, the war-fighting governments of Europe are using a private actor in the United States for the purposes of grand strategy. And the question is, of course, is how on earth is J.P. Morgan in this position? And the answer is that Wall Street at the beginning of the 20th century is not the big beast that we know today. It's a very underdeveloped financial market. America doesn't even have a Federal Reserve Bank until 1913 to arbitrate the movements of the American banking system in the interests of the American public. So J.P. Morgan is overwhelmingly the most powerful actor, financial actor in the United States. Totally dominate lending on Wall Street and has very long-standing family connections to the City of London. And so J.P. Morgan is not just in this for business purposes. One has to be clear about this. The scale of the wager on Morgan's part goes well beyond anything that could conceivably be justified in terms of profit maximization. I mean, it's a huge gamble of his bank and the stability of the American financial system on a victory by one side in a war which in 1915, 1916, and even as late, frankly, as the summer of 1918, swings back and forth between both sides. So Morgan is himself engaged, if you like, in a kind of grand strategy in which he is committing a vast share of America's economy to the European war effort. And this then, of course, for Washington poses really very fundamental questions. Ever since the late 19th century, the American political class had been in deep, agonized discussions about how to manage the new monopoly capitalism, the new oligopolistic capitalism that has emerged in America in the late 19th century.
We're still there, aren't we? I mean, we're still talking about it.
And there are indeed fundamental analogies between the banking power that we face today in the early 21st century and then. We are today, too, talking about very basic questions of the relationship between public and private power.
You speak of World War I then, and it may be a bit of a euphemism, as a kind of public private partnership decisively led by the private and J.P. Morgan. But so come back to Woodrow Wilson. Was he led by the money? I mean, we think of him as one of the strongest minds, PhD president, great intellectual with a big vision. But did he become a tool of J.P. Morgan in the end or not?
I think the crucial thing to recognize here is that this is not a struggle, the struggle between public power and capitalism, which has its greatest arena in the United States, is not, however, a struggle confined to the United States. And there is, I think, an abiding tendency on the part of American critics to think this too parochially, to think this in too narrowly national terms. And the drama of 1917 cannot be understood without the Germans. I mean, the thing that forces Wilson's hand is not J.P. Morgan. Wilson had J.P. Morgan by the neck, by the throat. He was throttling J.P. Morgan's business in early 1917. What makes it impossible for him to continue on those lines is not the power balance within the United States, but the fact that Germany launches its U-boats against the American shipping from February 1917, and then engages in a spectacular act of aggression in trying to mobilize the Mexicans for an invasion of Texas, and then furthermore doesn't even attempt to deny that, but in fact publicly admits that this was indeed an act of German diplomacy. And at that point, no president is in a position to say, well, we'll stand back, we're too proud to fight, we'll do another Lusitania. At that point, America is clearly under attack. Hundreds of American seamen, thousands of American seamen's lives are at risk. America must defend itself. And at that point, the Germans forced Wilson's hand. This is not a drama that is acted out entirely within the boundaries of the United States. What gives Morgan, as it were, his wish is not his power over Washington, but the fact that Wilson loses his grip on the international diplomacy.
That was Adam Tooze. He's a professor of history at Yale. His book on World War I is called The Deluge, coming soon to a bookstore near you. There's a lot more of that interview with Adam Tooze on our website, radioopensource.org. Isabel Hull at Cornell, welcome to Open Source.
Thank you.
You're our expert, Isabel Hull, on the German general staff and their thinking. Adam Tooze makes you wonder just how crazy were they. I mean, he's saying, we're talking about Kaiser Wilhelm and his infamous generals, but Adam Tooze is saying if they had held off their U-boats, and the whole submarine war against American shipping in the Atlantic, Woodrow Wilson would have stayed out of the war, and they probably would have prevailed in some fashion.
Well, it's the Germans certainly made it, I quite agree with Adam Tooze, made it impossible for Wilson to do anything else. He hesitated for an extremely long time. He was under great pressure, including from his Secretary of State, Robert Lansing, to come in. He hesitated for months, but finally he was in fact driven to do so by the German submarine campaign.
What were they thinking?
They were thinking that it was a wonder weapon. They were thinking two things. They were thinking that the United States had financially and in terms of making armaments had already thrown its weight onto the side of the Allies, and so therefore it didn't matter whether the United States was actually in the war because it was, according to their thinking, already in the war by proxy. And they also believed 1917 was the nadir of German victories and so on in the war. And what they believed was that the this new weapon, which over which they had a monopoly, would be a wonder weapon, would win the war.
The submarine.
The submarine, yes, and that the only way that the submarine could be used was through what was known as unrestricted submarine warfare, which meant that you did not follow customary international law and remove passengers and crews before sinking unarmed, neutral, and even enemy merchant vessels. You simply sank them.
You can hear a certain crazy logic in that when they're faced with the great naval power of England and the rising power of the United States. What was wrong with it?
What was wrong with it is that in a war of attrition, you don't bring in the greatest financial armaments and demographic power against you. And the Chancellor, Bethmann Hollweg, knew that that was true, and he knew, in fact, that the war was going to be lost if the United States came in it. He had tried for 2 years successfully to prevent the Navy and the General Staff from sort of forcing the Kaiser to make the decision to do unrestricted submarine warfare. But in the end, he simply was not strong enough to keep that up. And so that decision was made in January of 1917. And from then on in, really, the war was lost. There was one bright moment for the Germans, and that was, of course, when the Russian Revolution and especially the Second Russian Revolution took Russia out of the war. And there was then that brief moment. This is at the end of 1917 and the beginning of 1918, when Germany then pins all of its hopes militarily on an offensive in March of 1918, designed to win the war before the American troops can land and turn the tide of victory. That was as impossible, but also as logical as the Schlieffen Plan of 1914. And in the end, three different offensives beginning in March 1918 did not work.
I'm glad you mentioned the Schlieffen Plan, which a lot of people blame for triggering the whole cascade. But let me ask you an amateur question. Both you and Steve and Isabel, at Versailles, Germany was the bad guy, villainized for the whole thing. My sense is that after a lot of waltzing around in 100 years, we've come back to pin the tail on Germany for the whole thing, significantly with the help of Fritz Fischer, a German historian, who said, we've done it. Is that a fair generalization, Isabel or Steve Van Ever? You're smiling.
Well, go ahead, Itzy.
No, Steve and I both were talking about this just before your program began. Fritz Fischer was, of course, from the German side, the first German historian who writing in 1959 who said that. But of course, numerous historians, including Hans Gatzke, Luigi Albertini, Bernadotte Schmidt, had written that beforehand. What has happened, unfortunately, in the last 2 years, in honor of the centenary, is that a number of historians have sort of erased Fischer and gone back to the German innocence routine of the 1920s and 1930s. And so we are actually back fighting the same battles that Fritz Fischer fought in the late 1950s and early 1960s.
Back to the sort of, we just blundered into this thing, we don't know how it happened, and it was a march of folly, and God knows, let's not do it again, or something. Steve, is that your sense of it?
Yes, I agree with what Itzy just said. I think the evidence of German responsibility or prime responsibility for the war is overwhelming. And the only thing you can criticize the Fischer guys, which was the historical community in Germany that, you know, really put the case together in the 60s, is that they didn't, if you will, sort and order their evidence very carefully. They provided the world with massive amounts of evidence, but they basically left the reader to kind of add it up and sort it in order, which left room for people to come along later and make a great mess of it. I think that the great ungiven Nobel Peace Prize is to the Fischer School, who in the end changed the terms of debate in Germany about Germany's responsibility for the First World War, deserve great credit for, if you will, bringing Germany back in from the cold, creating a culture in Germany of admission and contrition for past wrongdoing. And they make a very convincing case if you look at all their evidence, and it exasperates me that people are today, you know, writing books that don't reflect a full reading of that evidence.
Well, all of Europe is observing the centennial, and they're trying to be polite. But would you say that the lesson of German responsibility is broadly accepted in German families, German kitchens, German thinking about their history?
Ironically, I think it's more accepted in Germany than outside Germany. It's very rare you see that kind of pattern in the world where a society takes more blame for its wrongdoing than outsiders do. But the Fischer School view is the mainstream and majority view inside Germany. You find more critics of Fischer, oddly, outside Germany today.
I want to ask you both, again, apologies for being an amateur, but two counterfactuals. The first one is, what if Woodrow Wilson had stayed out of the war? As he said he would. Niall Ferguson has raised the question whether Britain should have entered the war, and what if they hadn't? But what if they called for a war and nobody had showed up, including the Americans? Stephen Ever.
It's a great question. My view is that Germany would have won the war. Now, this is as he said, the key hammer that fell on Germany, made him lose the war, was U.S. entry. That was the great German blunder during the war, was bringing the U.S. in. If the Germans had found a way to keep the U.S. out, I think in the end the Germans probably would have won.
Could we have lived with the result?
Well, my own quick and dirty guessing is that Germany would have been taking over a European empire. They had huge imperial aims in Europe. They declared in 1914, or they decided among themselves, that they were aiming to create a huge sphere of influence that basically included the Low Countries, France, large parts of Russia, and so on. So they would have created an empire.
But Kaiser Bill was no Hitler. I mean,
well,
what if?
And my bottom line is they would have been taking over an empire at exactly the age when empires became both of little value and very hard to govern. And after a few years, they would have grown mightily weary of, if you will, intifadas throughout their wonderful empire. They would have spent a lot of time in the French Riviera learning how to drink French wine and, losing their, if you will, cutting edge for whacking heads, and would have done what everyone did in the 20s and 30s, which is gotten rid of their empire. Now, the counter argument is that they waged World War I with an unusually vicious spirit. The German view of their neighbors and of how to conduct their affairs with others had, if you will, a murderousness to it that was special and unique. And suggests that maybe they, my happy scenario wouldn't have happened.
Hold it there. I want to hear the counterfactual responses from you too, Isabel Hall. We're talking about some of the longer lessons learned over a century and some unlearned about the Great War and the Peace of Versailles. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source.
10 million mothers' hearts must break for the one who died in vain. Heads bowed down in sorrow in her lonely year, I heard a mother murmur through her tears. I didn't raise my boy to be a soldier. I brought him up to be my pride and joy.
And joy, who dares to place a musket on his shoulder to shoot some other mother's darling boy.
Isabel Hall, the historian at Cornell University, I want you to pick up the counterfactuals, but let me just say that song, I Didn't Raise My Boy to Be a Soldier, may be the first anti-war song in the age of recorded music. What if President Wilson hadn't gone to war? Could we have lived with the result in Europe, Isabel Hall?
I quite agree with Steve that the German aims in the First World War, and that was Fischer's title of his first book, was exactly what Steve said. He forgot Scandinavia. That would also have been pulled into the German orbit. And I also agree that this would have been intolerable for those who would have been drawn into the German Empire, as it were. Interestingly enough, the German Foreign Office in October of 1914 was asked this same question by Bethmann Hollweg in relation to Belgium and taking over Belgium and what that would cost and how it would work out. And their conclusion was that you would have to spend an enormous amount of military power in simply repressing a constant, as Steve said, intifadas against German rule. And that, I think, is if Germany had won the war, that would have been what would have happened. But I actually don't think Germany probably could have won the war. I think the stalemate would have gone on. Austria-Hungary was desperate to leave the war. It had achieved its war aim at the end of 1915 by crushing Serbia. And it was trying to get out of the war for the last 2 years of the war. And I don't think either Britain or France would ever have given in. It's hard to see how the war would have ended. And in the archives, there are lots of plans on all sides for what to do after a war that ended inconclusively. And everybody, the British, the French, the Germans, all believed that the war would pick up it would at first be an economic war between the two sides, and that at some point a military war would begin again.
I'm thinking about, you know, so many possibilities, but Britain and France wouldn't have had a chance to divide up and rename and remap the Middle East. The Ottoman Empire might have survived. What would Germany have made of all that?
Do you mean if there had been a stalemate?
Yes, and... or even a you know, a close German victory.
Germany was actually out to expand toward the southeast, and at some point would have bumped up against the Ottoman Empire there, even though they were their allies. And it's also rather clear that Germany would have in some way or another swallowed up Austria-Hungary. There's a one in Karl Kraus, who was a very famous Austrian journalist and writer
and wit,
and the author of The Last Days of Mankind, the best single work to come out of World War One, has wonderful scenes of Germany lording it over Austria-Hungary, and that in fact was the future that Austria faced if Germany had won. In fact, it would have been also drawn in a subordinate position to a German-dominated Europe.
Stephen Ever.
I think if Germany had won the war, Itzi may well be right that the war would have ended stalemate, but if they'd won the war, they would have basically been turning themselves into Austria-Hungary. They would have been turning themselves into a multi-ethnic state comprised of many fractious nationalities, none of whom liked each other and all of whom didn't want to join the army and fight for the Reich, and would have, in the end, Austria was you know, on the edge of coming apart in 1914, Germany would have been putting itself in that same position. I think German expansionism was sort of a madcap adventure. The idea of launching a huge colonial imperial enterprise right when the age of nationalism was bursting forth and the spread of small arms was making, you know, resistance to imperial control stronger and stronger was just it was a madcap thing to do. You know, think about what happened the next 30 years. The British, French, Portuguese, all the European empires fell apart under the resistance of the conquered peoples. And for the Germans were just putting themselves crosswise to nationalism and crosswise to history.
Isabel Hull, I want you to react to what Steve said at the outset, that this was the war that poisoned the century. You said, in effect, that the poison was there, including the machine gun and all the armaments and all the hostilities, and that the problem with the war was that it didn't eliminate the poison. Explain that.
Yeah. This relates to an earlier conversation you and I had in which I pointed out that the war didn't drop out of the sky and suddenly produce all of these awful things. The war was, in part, the result of a number of structural developments relating to nationalism, to these enormous technological developments in destructive power, in isms of social Darwinism and extreme nationalism, and so on and so forth, that were exacerbated in the war and were formed in ways that perhaps they might not have been without the war. And I certainly agree with Steve that communism in the shape that we then knew it afterward, and fascism and National Socialism are directly results of World War One. There's no question that those things would not have developed without the war. I think that's very clear. but in terms, sort of in a larger sense, if you think about it, the European agreement in 1815 at the close of the Napoleonic Wars, which were for Europeans at that point equally horrible, that consensus had been loosened, and Germany was at the forefront of really trying to overthrow that. And there's a way in which that kind of worldwide consensus has eluded us ever since, and we have tried in 1919 at the Treaty of Versailles with the League of Nations and so on to put together a different security system. We tried again after 1945 with the United Nations. And in a way, the OSCE after in the 1970s, but especially after the fall of the Soviet Union in 1989, is another attempt. But none of these have really had the purchase or created the stability that Europe enjoyed from 1815 to 1914.
Would you hold it right there, Isabel? I want to leave us time to go very, very big picture here. With Steve Van Era, I've been looking at movies, real movies of the war, of the trenches, of the suffering, of the surgery, of the effects, lifelong effects, devastating effects of poison gas. I mean, it was a horrific scene. And really sobered the world in profound ways. But to me, the puzzle is why war was not dethroned forever after. I mean, before the war, there was astonishing enthusiasm, but let's get it on. War is the strength of the state, all that kind of crazy madness. After the war, there was an unbelievable sobering up, and yet you can look back on the war not as the war to end war, but the war to model war for the 20th century in so many ways. What happened in the thinking about it to this moment, Steve? I mean, the counterfactuals didn't happen. We're stuck with this horrific record of killing.
My sort of short answer to that is that no steps were taken after World War II to get rid of the bad ideas that helped
World War II or one?
Sorry, after World War I.
Okay.
The missing piece of Versailles was the occupation of Germany. There was no occupation of Germany. As a result, the German, if you will, myth makers were allowed to run wild in the German schools, the German universities, and throughout German society. There was no, if you will, idea piece to Wilson's peace.
Interesting.
He had lots of kind of fancy ideas about how to make the peace happen. Let's get rid of the German general staff, and let's have more free trade, and let's have a UN or the League of Nations and so on. But he didn't address the idea piece. And to me, the 20th century, both World War I and World War II, were basically wars of illusions. These were wars of bad ideas. To tame the demons that caused those wars, you've got to address the bad ideas that gave rise to them. To me, today, the lesson is, number one, we may need some new NGOs that will undertake the mission of focusing on bad ideas that cause wars. Itzi was just talking about one of them, which is hypernationalism. I think we need a new NGO. I kind of jokingly call it Amnesia International, which would be an NGO that would cause societies to have to remember those things about history they would otherwise like to forget. And we actually do have a couple of organizations that are dedicated to that. We just need a lot more of it because myth-making about the past is a fundamental cause of war. And we need today, we have a new kind of identity politics that's very ugly, religious extremism. And I think we need Religious Hate Watch. We need an organization that's going to name and shame those who use God's authority for hate. And there's no organized opposition to those, demagogues who want to use religious authority for hate. There needs to be an opposition. The U.S., and I'm recommending NGOs, I also think the U.S. government has totally lost its mojo in what used to be called public diplomacy or in its efforts to shape discussion and opinion abroad. During the late World War II, Roosevelt mobilized all of Hollywood to basically delegitimate Nazism and legitimate the war. And spent
Thank you, Casablanca.
Yes,
Humphrey
exactly.
Bogart and all that.
Sure, and all the other stuff. Half of Hollywood was spent on it. And then in the early Cold War, the U.S. spent great effort, very competently. Today, our foreign policy is utterly militarized. There's no, idea piece in the current U.S. efforts, especially against al-Qaeda, but, worldwide. The answer in Washington is, when you see a problem, reach for a gun. And my view is we will not win the war on al-Qaeda until we change the terms of debate. We have to defeat the al-Qaeda narrative. And that can't be done by military means. That's got to be done by arguing, by explaining, by countering what's said in the way that Roosevelt did in World War II, and Ike did a very good job in the late 40s and early 50s.
Isabel Hull, your own lessons and the ones we may have forgotten.
No, I quite agree with Steve on that. There was a great wave of pacifism and sort of learning from the horrors of the First World War, But in Germany, it was largely blocked precisely by the kinds of efforts that were both undertaken by the government, by the Foreign Office, but then that ran rampant in political parties and different kinds of public groups, so that a large core of people then were prepared to go out and start World War II. It is perfectly clear, though, and when World War II started and Hitler announced it from a balcony, there was a very sullen crowd in Berlin in 1939. In fact, I think it's pretty clear that the German people as a whole didn't want to go to war in 1939. They then were won over by the ease of the victories in the first 2 years and decided that was a really good idea. But then as the war turned, and especially with the bombing campaign and then finally with the really utter destruction of the Third Reich, that finally finished this idea in Central Europe that war was a useful tool of politics.
Could I get you both, please, just to speak in those terms about the American consensus, especially around Woodrow Wilson? He's referred to now as a muscular Democrat, but he was also a visionary of a very peculiar American role as the kind of global trustee of a world of failed empires. And there was both an idealism in it, and also the Europeans suspected a kind of meta-empire of our own. How has that vision played out, Steve? And did we get there finally after World War II? Are we handling the role in anything like a wise manner? Bring it home.
I think Wilson blew it at Versailles. I think he had a lot of hubris about his ability to divine the causes of World War I and the antidotes. And I think he basically made a list of causes that were off the mark, and his antidotes were largely ineffective. Like, I just
was also confused by the fact that he'd run against the war and then plunged in 6 months into it. But speak of the vision of the United States, not in the Teddy Roosevelt fashion as sort of taking our place at the table, but taking our place sort of beyond the table, policing the world in a Wilsonian kind of wisdom that he never got to implement.
Well, I think the whole Wilson story should be essentially a teaching of humility to Americans, because Wilson's objective was to create a world that would be a peaceful world. He entered the war in part because he felt that American power could now be the agency of bringing about a warless world. And where he went wrong was that he assumed he could figure out what levers to pull and what buttons to push to make a peaceful world. And he completely failed to do that. You know, all he produced was a 20-year truce. I mentioned earlier that he didn't have an answer to the idea problem, right? World War I happened because the Germans drank a lot of bad Kool-Aid, and he did not have a program for bringing them back from that Kool-Aid. The second fundamental cause of World War I was insecurity. It was the widespread sense throughout Europe that each state was insecure and had to cut the other down before they were cut down, because conquest was easy and security was scarce. Therefore, some new security system had to be created, and he failed to do that. He put all of his poker chips on the League of Nations, which was an impractical, non-workable security institution. There were other ways he could have operated, but he didn't do it.
Let me just say, we're coming back to the subject of World War I and the period next week and the week after, in culture, in music, in all manner of things. But for the moment, thank you, Steve Van Evere and Isabel Hall. Thank you, Adam Tooze, too. Please visit us at radioopensource.org for more on the Great War and the world it created in art, in literature, in music. Leave your own marker there, too. There's a much longer excerpt, as I said, of our interview with Adam Tooze on our site. Our show this week was produced by our doughboys, Max Larkin, Connor Gillies, and our engineer, George Hicks. Mary McGrath is our field general. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time for Open Source. To please their king, they've all gone out to war.
and devil, and I'm bad. Kings up there are bigger devils than your dad. They're breaking the hearts of mothers, making butchers out of brothers. You'll find more hell up there than there is down